Hello, this is Fergus Nicol with World Business Report. We're coming to you today live from Louisville, Kentucky, as Americans wait to hear President Trump deliver his first State of the Union address to the joint houses of Congress in Washington, D.C. I'll ask, how might we expect allies and critics in his audience to respond?
Sometimes it can go from polite listening to impolite disagreeing. And in recent years, there have been disagreements.
I've been traveling south over the past week through Ohio and Kentucky, meeting the people who put the president in the White House, getting their assessments on what he's achieved so far in economic terms, and asking what they want him to do next.
I think he gets an A. Taxes are going down. All these large businesses are giving back huge bonuses to their employees.
Welcome to World Business Report. Let's start the program by examining the State of the Union as a political event, an event that's expected to be watched by around 40 million people. Professor Jasmine Farrier is acting chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Louisville, and she's a specialist in the U.S. Constitution.
The Constitution does not make it an annual address nor a live address. The Constitution says that the president shall, from time to time, inform Congress of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. So I think between John Adams and Woodrow Wilson, there were no live State of the Union addresses. There was simply a list of ideas that was given from the president to the presiding officers of the chambers.
Is it a consultation or is it an edict?
It's a little bit of both. The pageantry of the modern address is very important to establishing the president's primacy in constitutional affairs, which is not exactly how the document itself would have had it. But in modern times, the president commands center stage, literally, with the silent, sometimes loud applause of the audience, and that's both chambers of Congress and, of course, their honored guests, members of the cabinet, and even of the Supreme Court. So he has the nation's attention. And he has an opportunity to give his version of our State of the Union and also, again, recommend some new policy measures with the hope that his address will reach over the heads of the audience into homes across the United States. And those constituents and idea generators will themselves pressure Congress.
And you mentioned members of the Supreme Court. I guess that's important because that's the third crucial branch of the government. Do they play a role at all, or is this simply a listening exercise, a polite inclusion?
Well, sometimes it can go from polite listening to impolite disagreeing. And as you may know, in recent years, there have been disagreements, and one was quite stark between President Obama essentially criticizing a Supreme Court's decision in the Citizens United case and prompting a member of the Supreme Court, Samuel Alito, to mouth in a way that was obvious what he was saying. He was saying not true. In other words, the president was criticizing a Supreme Court decision directly, and a sitting member of the court was right there to tell the audience that he thought the president was misinterpreting the opinion. That's very unusual. And it's those types of political spectacles that are considered somewhat distasteful for the Supreme Court, and I know that at least one member is not going to be attending tonight, and that's Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
But that case you cite, Citizens United, is an important one because that continues to resonate because that's all about campaign finance, an issue that may yet be refought, I guess.
Absolutely. So the court, I think, is in an uncomfortable position for a couple of reasons. Members of the court are appointed by the president in a two-step process. He nominates and then the Senate confirms. Of course, there is going to be an ideological difference between liberal-leaning, conservative-leaning, and sometimes moderate-leaning justices, depending upon which party and which president put them in office. So it can look like a critical or approving spectacle for them just to sit there and nod along being polite.
I'm going to follow you along this legal line just for a moment, because I learned recently that while we all look at the Supreme Court nominations, lower down the spectrum, a lot of Mr. Trump's early initiatives have been overturned at the appellate level. And I understand that he's trying to change the profile at that level. That's quite an important reach into the system by the president.
Yes, and this is one of the more hidden success stories of Trump's presidency. So every president has opportunities at all three levels of the United States court system. So we have the Supreme Court, which is the most visible. On average, over several decades, presidents get around two per term. Some presidents are unlucky. Jimmy Carter served 4 years and not a single member of the Supreme Court died or retired. Other presidents are, you might call, more lucky than others if they get 2, 3, or 4 appointments. In the lower courts, though, that's less visible to the average person, but there are over 80 districts of courts throughout the United States, and there are 12 circuits. And the president thus far, I think, has appointed 12 judges across the appellate circuits, of which there are dozens of judicial seats. Now, as far as openings, though, that's a much more complicated question. So even President Obama had openings, but he was unable to get some of those confirmations through the Senate. When those confirmations are stagnant, they just continue on until the next person is president. And then depending upon whether the president wants the old nominees, they may withdraw. And in this case, President Trump has been very successful. And that's in part due to the filibuster being declined by the previous majority. But I won't get into that until we need to.
Well, that's interesting. And it comes back to, again, this constitutional relationship and how that works in practice between the president and the Congress. 1 year now of a Republican-dominated Congress, both houses. How would you assess the working relationship between the two?
It's certainly complicated. So one of the most frustrating or perhaps relieving features, depending upon what side you're on, of the United States political system is its complicated separation of powers structure. So each chamber, the House and the Senate, are independently elected from each other and from the president. So you can have the same party majority, of course, but each individual is a winner in a specific district in the House or in the state, in the Senate. The president's electoral clock, his constituency, his main points of view are all on a separate clock under separate constitutional circumstances. So in other words, they all are designed to see the same world differently, and they certainly do. So that has complicated the workings of any president who, absent an enormous majority, would not be able to easily get things through.
Thanks to Dr. Jasmine Farrier at the University of Louisville. Now, as I mentioned earlier, World Business Report's been on something of a road trip this past week, exploring the key themes that are affecting people's working lives here. We started up in Cleveland. It's up on Lake Erie, with Canada, of course, over the water to the north. And that's simultaneously one of America's most successful cities and least successful cities. And that depends largely on where you live and what kind of job you do or did. Music streams into the street outside Cleveland's House of Blues. I'm on the northern lake coast of one of America's most dynamic and economically important states, at the start of a journey south to find out simply how Ohio is getting on. Now, this is what they call a blue town, a locked-up Democratic Party stronghold, but Ohio is a red state that swung decisively for Donald Trump. So while you'll find plenty of people who don't like the president, that doesn't mean you can't find people who do admire what he's doing for American business.
I think he gets an A. Taxes are going down. All these large businesses are giving back huge bonuses to their employees. I think people are just way too scared to say what they believe and stand up for what they think. Society these days is so politically correct. If you say you're a Trump supporter somewhere, I mean, you don't want to get like sticks thrown at you because you just don't say it. So you may hide a little bit, but I think if you start diving in and talking to people, at the end of the day, they really do believe in what he's doing.
Iguodala to inbound.
Two things gave Cleveland a huge boost in 2016, basketball and politics.
It's over! It's over! Cleveland is a city of champions once again! The Cavaliers are NBA champions!
Local hero LeBron James came back to the Cleveland Cavaliers and took them to the NBA championship.
Cleveland's long sports nightmare has ended. The drought is over. 52 years.
And the city secured the Republican National Convention, the party jamboree that confirmed Donald Trump as candidate.
Critics and cynics, all of the people telling you you can't have the country you want, are the same people that wouldn't stand. I mean, they said Trump doesn't have a chance of being here tonight. Not a chance. The same people. We love defeating those people, don't we? Don't we love defeating those people? Love it, love it, love it.
I'm Elizabeth McIntyre, publisher and editor of Crane's Cleveland Business. I think that Cleveland started gaining self-confidence, something it's certainly lacked for decades. And I think nobody was more down on Cleveland than Clevelanders were. We see more and more when people who were raised here, who go on out of state to college, find that first job elsewhere, they're going to likely boomerang back when they start to have a family, because their family's here, number one. Second is the low cost of living. And third, it's a great place to raise your family. So when they boomerang back, when they start looking, if we don't have the professional jobs available to attract them, we're going to lose them. And that's our window of opportunity. So it's incumbent on business leaders to ensure that they have the prospects to bring these young people back to town. We have a fair number of law firms that are based here, as well as accounting firms. And I think those are the sectors that really can draw these professional young people back to town.
So I want to thank the public. I want to thank the public for ultimately supporting me.
Frank Jackson is Cleveland's mayor, re-elected last November for a fourth term with some big problems to solve.
We are a Rust Belt city, heavy industry. That's a thing of the past. Those were tens of thousands of jobs lost in this city. Jobs going offshore, and those were corporate and political decisions, not necessarily to the benefit of local communities. That is the shortcoming of government and the private sector in America. And so what we're attempting to do is to have it so that whenever we have investments, that it has a better equity and that the disparity is substantially lower.
If that incoming wealth is being spread, what's the best way to use it if manufacturing jobs are going, if not gone?
The question that you're asking me is a much deeper question, because it goes to the basic core of the issue. How do you empower those who you have traditionally or intend to oppress when your whole social and economic structure is based on that oppression? These are very systemic issues you have to deal with. And just in a political sense, I could do some things and claim victory, but that will not really have any great impact in terms of the systemic nature of disparity. Cleveland's next level in terms of whether or not what we've done so far and whether or not it will be sustainable for any period of time and have any shelf life will be based on how those areas that have been traditionally left out and the people who have been traditionally left out, whether or not we are able to address the inequity and the disparity of that.
There are places along this route south where realizing the American dream is proving extremely hard. I've pulled the car over in Maple Avenue in one of the suburbs of Canton, Ohio. Union Metal is a big employer in this area, or at least it was a big employer. It's just passed its 100th anniversary, a proud history, and it's announced that it's closing this year. There's a house over there that's windows are boarded up. Next door neighbors, their front stoop's fallen through, and the porch has just collapsed into the front yard. It's not getting easier for anybody to make their lives smooth.
My name's Jan Walther, 1836 Maple Avenue, Northeast, Canton, Ohio. My grandpa started back in 1914. My dad took it over in, I think, 60, and I took it over in 1981.
How's the neighborhood changed?
My God, the neighborhood not what it used to be. Part of the problem is we've lost most of our industrial already. That's the main problem. Our youth has disappeared. They're going to Columbus, they're going to Chicago, all parts of the country.
Is there anything that could bring back the life to this part of the county?
Yeah, jobs. Jobs are number one.
And we've heard right from the president's campaign, right through his first year in office, he's the man who's doing this. Does that bring hope?
that the jobs will come?
We sure hope so, but every president promises that and they never come through with it. Hopefully this gentleman does.
Have you liked what you've seen so far?
Yeah, he's done fine. We needed a change. We needed somebody with business background, and hopefully he runs it like a business instead of like a government.
I'm heading towards the end of my journey now, which means I'm about to cross the Ohio River into Kentucky, traveling from the Buckeye State into the Bluegrass State. And I've parked up to look at one of the biggest infrastructure challenges in this part of America. And what you can hear is the thunder of traffic on the 54-year-old Brent Spence Bridge. And President Trump has promised to replace the bridge because it's simply not fit for purpose on one of the nation's biggest trucking routes. I'm going to talk to Jill Mayer of the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber to find out from her why the bridge matters so much.
First of all, that bridge carries almost 4% of our GDP. Everybody coming from as far as Michigan to far south as Florida, that is a major artery right there for commerce. Bridges are designed to carry certain amount of traffic, and they are designed certainly with safety and flow in mind. It was designed to have three lanes with two emergency lanes. Both of those emergency lanes have been eliminated. So I don't know if you experienced it in your drive across the bridge, but traffic is tight and fast, and there are lots of people trying to make lots of different lane changes in a very short span. So it's effectively outlived what it was designed to carry because we have changed what it is carrying and we've not constructed the bridge to keep up with that traffic.
That's Jill Mayer of the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber. Thanks to her and everyone else who took part in our report. Americans expecting there to hear Mr. Trump talk about infrastructure during the State of the Union. Let's get back to Ohio and the bigger picture, though, to explore some of the themes we've just been hearing. I spoke to Professor Ned Hill of Ohio State University in Columbus.
It's very clear to acknowledge there are now two Ohios. There is the Ohio, which is clustered around its major metropolitan areas and the suburbs around it. They've come back quite nicely, with one exception being a part of the eastern part of Cleveland. And that is being driven by the auto industry bounce back. We had a bunch of German investment around I-75, which is a western highway, which is connects Detroit with Kentucky. So that's really is the auto parts highway. Just the other day, the dumping decision came down on Korean washing machines. So we have the largest washing machine and appliance factories in the United States. They're both Whirlpool plants. We've seen a very strong resurgence in medical employment. So the single largest employer in the state is the Cleveland Clinic. They are the fourth largest provider of graduate medical education in the United States. And the largest single point of employment is down in Southwest Ohio, and that's the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. They employ 20-some-odd thousand, but that region is hurting. And our second largest employer is Walmart. So if you think about what's going on within the state, labor markets are extremely tight in the Columbus region, getting very tight in Cincinnati. Cleveland, they're tightening. But then when you get into rural Ohio, small town Ohio, which traditionally was one or two Fortune 1000 companies back that blew out in the 60s or 70s, they're losing population. Unemployment rates are high. And we're dealing with a pretty substantial opioid and fentanyl crisis right now. Those are farming communities, old line manufacturing communities, but they've got now the same social indicators as some of the traditional low-income urban neighborhoods. So the challenge for the state is to continue the resurgence of the advanced part of the economy, but we have to start figuring out how to pay attention to the other Ohio.
When it comes to jobs, one of the sort of shorthand answers for what we've seen is that jobs have consistently gone out of America. In Ohio, is it true that globalization as a general trend, specific trade agreements like NAFTA, have led to an outflow of jobs?
In today's age, I'm going to give you the wrong answer. It's not yes and it's not no. It's a little nuanced. So what has happened is NAFTA has been a huge net benefit to the state. The reason is we're an auto manufacturing state. That supply chain goes across both borders. We're also a very big agriculture state. So Mexico is a major client of ours. And this state is very dependent on the value of the dollar. When the dollar weakens, we do well. If it gets very expensive, we don't do well because we're so export dependent. Just as an example, North America's largest engine plant is in Anna, Ohio. It's a Honda plant. And every day a unit train leaves that plant to take engines to their factory in Mexico. So it's so interdependent. A critical part of making an automobile is the auto seat. They actually build the car around it because it's so big and has so much technology in it. Well, components of those seats go back and forth across the border with Mexico constantly. So if it's leather, it gets sewn down there. The electronics come in here. So if you take a simpleton axe to this, you'll cause massive damage. Now, the yes part, we did get an impact from China. So if you look at the rural semi-urban counties, there was large-scale employment loss. Now, my research team has done a lot of looking at this. And what we found out that most of the job loss isn't trade, it's automation. That is just opening up. And so what that's going to end up doing, it's going to up the skill level in manufacturing one more time. It's going to take the semi-skilled, high turnover positions. That's where the robots are going to go. I think that what we're going to have is you're going to see more companies opening, more capital in them, smaller employment base within it, and a continued decrease in demand for semi-skilled and unskilled labor.
Thanks to Professor Ned Hill of Ohio State. And as somebody else told me during my journey, you can't build a wall that'll keep the robots out. Ahead of the State of the Union, the Dow Jones on Wall Street posted its biggest drop since May 2017. It's 1.4% down on the day, Tuesday. Healthcare-related companies in particular seem to lose ground after an announcement by Amazon, JP Morgan and Berkshire Hathaway that they were going to join forces to create a healthcare firm aimed at cutting costs for their own US employees. I've been hearing about the day's trading from Joe Saluzzi at Themis Trading in New Jersey.
Yeah, you know, I think this is the long-awaited sell-off that many people have been waiting for. If you add up the 2 days, we're down a little bit less than 2% over the last 2 days on the S&P 500, which isn't that much. I mean, when you look at the headline number of a Dow down 361, it does seem to scare people. But when you're 26,000 in the Dow, those numbers, percentages are relative. So with that said, they really... The sell-off is warranted, most people think. There were some news today. The healthcare sector in particular was a little bit concerning about the joint operation potentially between Amazon, JP Morgan, and Berkshire. But overall, I didn't see anything that would really shake confidence that much.
What about the dollar?
The dollar is weaker. That is a relative thing, I think, when it comes to, obviously other countries as well. And, last week it was the Treasury Secretary actually trying to talk down the dollar, which was kind of interesting, and then the White House backed off of that. Definitely something to be concerned about, and we look at our yields. We're still below 3% on a 30-year. It's 2.97 right now, which doesn't exactly scream growth. But again, it is relative to other bonds around the world, so you have to kind of look at it both ways.
So when we look ahead to the State of the Union, Joe, we can expect President Trump to pretty forthright about claiming success, claiming perhaps even to be responsible for the stock market drive that we've seen recently. This isn't enough to dent that sense of optimism, perhaps.
No, not at all. I don't even think, when you look at 1 day or 2 days, that won't really matter much. When you look at the month, we're still actually up 5.5% for the month, which is tremendous. I mean, it's 5.5% for a month is really, you don't see that often. So I think it's been extremely successful. And I think what he'll tout, certainly the tax plan, which has had a huge kind of boost psychologically, yet to see in the paychecks, but they will see it soon. But then he's also going to talk about infrastructure spending. There's a plan on the table to spend over $1 trillion in infrastructure, as well as continued deregulation. And I think he touted a number last week that there were 22 regulations taken away for every new one that was put in, and he was only looking for 2 for 1. So, those have been the three pillars of the Trump presidency when it comes to the economy. All three of them, the market likes. As much as some people may not like deregulation, and there's certainly a lot of concerns there, the market loves it. So if those three continue to fire, I think the market will shake off the sell-off that we're having and certainly go to new highs by the end of the year.
Thanks to Joe Saluzzi with our market update. And your closing number on the Dow Jones for Tuesday, down that 1.4% I mentioned, 26,076. Just looking at a headline on the website of the Courier Journal, that's the local paper here in Louisville. Meet the injured Kentucky Marine, who's President Trump's guest at the State of the Union, a former Marine from Winchester, Kentucky, Corporal Matthew Bradford. who lost his vision and both his legs in Iraq. He'll be the president's guest for the State of the Union on Tuesday evening. Right, we're winding up towards the end of this edition of World Business Report. Let's bring you a few more voices of the people that we've been meeting during our journey south from Ohio to Kentucky.
I like his policies, tax cuts. It will help small business cut the regulations, which is very important for business.
So I like the guy. I think he's doing a fine job. I really do. I think he's done a lot for us already. We brought a lot of justice back in around the areas, so making everybody aware of how much money's getting spent, how much money's getting blown. He's brought some big companies back in already.
His personality mostly, I think it's not the best personality for a president. I just don't think I like him as a person. I was an immigrant. I'm a citizen now, but as soon as he was in the ballot, I submitted my citizenship application. So
there's a lot of people who are bashers of Trump, and I think that's strictly jealousy. Nobody in this right mind thought that Donald Trump would be the president of the United States, and they are so mad, all the politicians, because he's not a politician. He's a businessman. And I personally think everything is fine. If they just would leave the man alone and let him do his job.
Thanks to everybody who spoke to the BBC on our journey south. Now, that's it for this edition of World Business Report. But if you can be with the BBC World Service at 1 o'clock GMT, we're going to start a couple of hours of special coverage. Here in Kentucky, we'll have an hour of special coverage ahead of that State of the Union address. And I'll be reporting from the state. We'll be meeting some more of the voters who put Mr. Trump in the White House. We'll then throw to Washington at 9 p.m. local for the speech itself. Hope you can join us on the BBC.